Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org, a nonprofit, member-supported radio station. We're millions strong, with folks tuning in from over 200 countries. We are education. We are entertainment. We are the future of food. May is our membership drive. Become a member and support us while receiving e-newsletters, advanced invites, special discounts, and a membership card. We need your support. Visit our website and click the donate button to become a member today. Thank you for believing in us and enjoy the show.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli. And before we get started today, I just want to make a little note that all throughout the month of May, we're going to be doing a membership drive. So if you want to go to the website, heritageradionetwork.org, and click donate, you'll actually be able to sign up for membership. I was actually a member even before I started the radio show. It's really fantastic. At any level of membership, you'll be able to receive a monthly e-newsletter, advanced invites to special events, special discounts with your membership card. And then there are various levels and you get all sorts of other really great goodies at each one of the levels. So check it out at heritageradionetwork.org and click donate to become a member. And now to get started, we have, I'm extremely excited, actually a really good friend of mine on the show today. Her name is Laura Wickowitz. She's the beverage director at Locanda Verde, one of just the most popular restaurants. I absolutely love it. It's one of those places where it just has this great, really upbeat downtown vibe. It's truly one of the most popular restaurants in the city. Andrew Carmelini, who's the chef, I feel like he's constantly in the news. He's constantly doing something exciting and he's kind of able to do something that I admire quite a bit. It's kind of a bigger, really popular restaurant where you do lots and lots of covers every night, but at an extraordinarily high quality. I think I went twice in 2 weeks because I think I went with my mom and my girlfriend, and then we loved it so much. The next week we brought her parents when they were in town. But anyway, Laura, thank you so much for being on the show. It's exciting to have you here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's so fun to be here.
You know, we go back a while. I've known for a while that you've had an interest in Italian wines. Before Locanda, you worked at Fig and Olive, where you were the beverage director across multiple restaurants.
That's right. That was a small program where we focused only on French, Italian, and Spanish wine. And I think getting to work side by side with those three sort of micro regions, well, that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but anyway, I got to explore Italy comparatively to the rest of Europe, and it was really exciting to be one of the few sommeliers I know where in my mind, Italy triumphed over France. And that's not to say I don't love French wine, but I think that love started there. It was a real value-driven menu, and when you're looking for wines at that $40 restaurant bottle price point, I think Italy really just shines.
And what drew you to Italian wines?
You know, there of course is an element of being Italian-American. I think those were the wines that were on my table growing up. They were the first wines I was exposed to. They were the wines my parents were excited about drinking. But then I do think it was being in that professional element of trying to find value-driven wines for the Fig and Olive list that really opened my eyes to different grape varieties that I had never heard of, and to realize that if you have, you know, just well, maybe that $50 breaking point on a bottle of wine in a restaurant, that a Trebbiano from Lugano may actually be more beautiful than a sort of average level Sancerre or something like that. And so it was just eye-opening to me.
And what do you mean by this $50 breaking point? Do you mean that at once you get to $50, you open up the world to another level of quality?
You know, I think that if you have... I think that modestly priced wine in Italy is more readily available than perhaps I see in France. I think you have to work a little harder, I'll say. And some of that probably is marketing and popularity, but $50 in a restaurant in Burgundy doesn't quite get you as far as it does, you know, in some of the lesser known white grapes. The best Trebbiano you ever could drink, perhaps, is $50, yeah. where you're just breaking into some of those white wines in the other regions. And I think, of course, there are exceptions. You know, I'm painting with very large, wide brushstrokes here, but I think that you, I think you have a lot to work with in the lower price point in Italy.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree, and that's what drew me also to Italian wines. I'd have to say, though, I think that in the Loire Valley and maybe in Beaujolais are sure. two places in France where you can get, at $50, like a pretty
Absolutely,
world-class
especially
wine.
If you're willing to step outside Sancerre, and I do agree with that. I mean, I've had wines from, you know, Quince that you'd never heard of. You're like, whoa, this is incredible. Of course. Of course.
Do you find that guests, is Sancerre, like one of those wines that guests like keep asking for?
Yeah.
What is up with that?
I don't know.
Guests ask for that all the time.
It's true. Sancerre, and this season more than ever, like Big is back. Everyone's asking for full-bodied California wines, and it's not something I've seen in the last 3 years. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, but it's been a recurring theme on the show that, you know, that everyone's been taught, distributors we've had on, winemakers, that, yeah, everyone's drinking lighter, everyone's drinking more old world, but I think
that pendulum is swinging back. It's swinging back. A little bit. Yeah. I don't know.
So, but before working in the New York restaurant scene, you went to the CIA and studied to be in the back of the house.
I was 100% back of the house driven. I had no intention of being in wine world until I went to culinary school. And actually, the week that I was graduating, I had a job with I'm embarrassed to blank on his name. Anyway, I apologize, chef. But the chef at Oceana, Ben Pollinger, there it is, told me that I went to him and said, chef, I'm debating doing this fellowship in the front of the house. I know I just promised you 2 years. And, you know, I don't know. I'm excited about wine, but I also think that this is an incredible job offer to be starting at a great restaurant in New York. This was back when Oceana was in its old space, not in the newly renovated restaurant. And he said, because he is a CIA graduate and really an advocate for the students, you know, if you do your fellowship, study wine, if you want your job in the kitchen in a year, I'll give it to you. And so I said, oh, all right, thanks, chef. And I kind of got out of my agreement with him, and I went back to the culinary and taught front-of-the-house service for a year and was able to start ticking away at those WSET accreditations and really never picked my knives up again.
And you never went back to Ben?
I've seen him since, and I've said, thanks, chef. I think I made the right choice. But I never did go back to the kitchen.
You know, if you had gone to Ben, it would have been another one of these random crazy coincidences, because my first job in any restaurant was at Union Square Cafe when Ben Pollinger was the he was the chef de cuisine, and I was in the kitchen.
Very cool.
And it was very cool. And
I didn't know you were in the kitchen.
Yeah. I didn't last very long. But it was a very, very eye-opening experience, and I think, like you, I'm much more drawn to the front of house experience. But Ben, I mean, what a great guy, and so dedicated to quality. It's just
truly
incredible, his eye for quality, his passion for it, and he just such a great guy.
I agree. He doesn't get the recognition he deserves. Anyone, if you're listening and you haven't heard of Chef Ben Pollinger, we're toasting him today.
Yeah, we are toasting Ben Pollinger in the drink. He's just he's the man. And you know, if you're in Midtown, that, you know, sometimes I think of Midtown as not having too many great restaurants, but Oceana is definitely like what great place to sit at the bar, get some raw food, fish, or even a composed dish. It's really delicious. So okay, so you did the front of house. You did a year. You were teaching. How do you go from back of house to teaching front of house classes? Did you have some experience before school?
No, I really didn't. The fellowship for front of the house at the CIA, because up to that point, there really aren't a lot of classes in dining room service. That you really are, it's just a few, you know, an introductory class to dining room and then an advanced. It's two little stints. I think it's based somewhat on potential. You know, they see people with an interest, but a lot of it is based on your wine scores and wine classes. And I always did well there just because I was interested, not because I thought of it as a career aspiration necessarily. So you're able to link up with those fellows if they see the potential there. That's more how those classes, I think the back of the house fellowships are a bit more competitive in that sense, that you really have had to establish yourself. But I had a nice relationship with the professor at that time, and just seemed really excited about wine, and so that was how that worked. And it was great. I mean, it was 1 year. Every 3 weeks, you had a new group of students, and you were teaching them how to open a bottle of wine and decant wine, and you know, you really get that eye for the dining room detail when every 3 weeks you're teaching people how to set a table and how to lay out linens. And from there, it just seemed like a natural progression into Restaurant Daniel, and that was how I broke into New York.
Wow, what a way to break into New York.
What a way to break into New York.
Before we get to Daniel, I want to ask a little bit more about CIA. I mean, anyone I know who's been to CIA has spoken extremely highly of it. Catherine, who's my business partner, she's the pastry chef at the restaurant. She's a CIA grad, and she just loves it. Do you think that it's something that is useful for someone in the front of house, or would you have rather?
Okay, absolutely. I think going through that program gave me such confidence in a restaurant atmosphere, and additionally understanding how dishes work. I know that I am a better sommelier because of pairing wine and food, because of an understanding of what's on the plate, of how, if a chef is building a sauce, the levels of acid that might go into that sauce. I mean, we don't serve wine without food. We serve wine with food. And so understanding that is, you're really seeing the whole picture. And you're just more confident in the dining room. You know, you're that middleman between the diner and the chef. And if you have an understanding of what's going on back there, everything transitions better.
I think that's a good point. So tell us about your first experience in New York at Daniel.
Sure. So, New York City is a tough city. If you have never worked in the front of the house of a restaurant, no one will hire you in the front of the house of a restaurant. So, like many young culinary students, I came out feeling kind of puffed up and ready for the world, ready for my first job as a wine director. And and I had the scariest interview of my life ever with Daniel Jonas, coming out of culinary school. And I mean, I was certainly not ready to be running a wine program. I was 23 years old, but I felt ready because I had been studying my maps of Burgundy, and I really felt ready. So Daniel Jonas gives me this interview for a wine position at the restaurant Daniel. Mostly, I'm sure, as a favor to my professor at CIA, frankly. And he has blank paper, and he has me drawing maps of Burgundy and plugging in Grand Cru villages. I mean, this is not how most wine interviews go, believe me.
I've been easy on my interviews.
Right? I had to open three bottles of wine and blind taste with him and tell him my thoughts on the wines, which was a Cabernet blend from Canada that I think I even said was Pacific Northwest, like where I pulled that from, but I remember him being kind of impressed at that. You know, anyway, we delineated, and he kind of said, so let me get this straight, though. You've never worked in a restaurant before, except in the back. And I said, no, of course not. And so he said, you can either, you know, join the wine team on a very, very entry level at Bar Balloud, which sounded to me more like a cocktail server, but anyway, I'd be getting my hands on the wines by the glass. Or he said, you know, take my advice and start at the very bottom and go to Restaurant Daniel and learn what it is to be in a restaurant of the greatest caliber. So that's what I ended up doing. I kind of put wine aside for now, since I had never actually worked in a restaurant before, short of the kitchen, and I spent about 9 months as a back waiter at the Restaurant Daniel. And then, you know, very quickly from there, kind of tacked out into more managerial roles. But that was my first experience, was serving bread and water at the Restaurant Daniel. But you have an eye for things there that you cannot recreate that experience anywhere. If I had gone to a more casual establishment as a manager, which I would have been qualified to do at that point, I mean, I had 2 college degrees, but I wouldn't have had the eye, and that's that Restaurant Daniel eye mirrored so much the training that CIA was trying to impart in me, and it was the perfect follow-up.
Yeah, you know, we've had Daniel Jonas on the show here. Mm-hmm. I think it's all come full circle now. But it sounds like you made the right decision. And your next job your first job as a manager in New York, what was that?
My first job as a manager in New York would have been Fig and Olive. I did a small stint in between Danielle and the Fig and Olive restaurant group at a restaurant called Dovetail on the Upper West Side, John Fraser's restaurant. And I was actually their fromagier, which is like an odd little side swipe to my wine career. But I'd studied cheese in school. I mean, that felt almost, that was like a middle position between kitchen and dining room somehow, to be wheeling around the cheese cart and talking about cheese. So again, less than a year I was there, but that was a great job.
I have to give John a hard time, but they have a fromagier, like that your whole job is around cheese the whole night.
You know, on certain nights you're a captain on the floor, but then the rest of the time you're kind of the fromagier. It's one of those swing positions. But I got to go down to the Murray's cheese cobs and pick out all the cheese on the carts and do the staff trainings and wheel the cart around the dining room. It was really a blast.
That's really fun. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. All right, so we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back shortly on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Butterscotch by Techstar on heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
And we're back on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. Just wanted to remind everyone that during the month of May, we're going to be doing our membership drive. I definitely recommend everyone signing up to be a member. If you want to go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on donate, there are various different levels of membership. I'm gonna go ahead and suggest doing the premium member for $250, where you'll get lots of really cool things, such as our newsletter. You'll get invites to events, a discount membership card, and you'll be able to also get a VIP backstage tour of our sick radio station in the back of Roberta's, and it's awesome, and you should do that. All right, so I'm here with Laura Wickowitz from Locanda Verde. We were getting a little bit about her history, but now I want to talk about Locanda. It's one of the most popular restaurants in New York City, and not only is it popular, but it's also extraordinarily high quality. It's a place that I really love, and I try to go there as often as possible. Tell us a little bit about what you're doing with the wine program at Locanda.
Sure. Locanda Verde's wine program, it's about 150 bottle list. I should have pre-thought about that. It's about 150 bottles under $150, I would say. That's the focus of the list, is affordability. But also, I try to work with as many small growers and small farmers and wines that you would not have heard of. I know there have been many articles this year about flack being given to sommeliers that have lists that you can't find something you've heard of. I think I am at times guilty of that. I have two Chiantis. I try and put things for everyone. But the more that you work with wine, the more you understand that there are people behind every bottle, and that there are families, and that there are stories. And if you drink that Kool-Aid, you really can't step away from it. So my wine list is a collection of friends, a collection of growers, a collection of farmers, and you hope that translates into something beautiful that adds to the experience, but also really goes with the food. La Canna Verde is not it's not a northern Italian restaurant. It's not a southern Italian restaurant. The dishes are very authentic to their place, but many places in Italy are represented on that menu. And so you have to mirror that with a wine list that has wines, you know, from top to bottom of that boot.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you brought it up, you know, I think you're referencing Lee Campbell over at Reynard, who's just, I really love her list. And I think even as someone in the wine industry, there's a ton of things on the list that
I wasn't naming names
that are like these new discoveries. How do you feel as a beverage director about the, you know, that those kind of articles, or just in general about having a list that challenges the guests in a certain
sure.
way?
I'm sympathetic to those articles. I really am. I have friends in the real world. I understand the necessity of having wines that appeal to everyone, and it's a little bit unfair to have a list that's so geeky that that you are required to engage with a sommelier. I think you should be encouraged to, but not required to. So I know how easy it is to feel compelled to have a super geeky list, but I strive actively to put wines on there that would have mass appeal, that would appeal to everybody. I think that we have some responsibility as wine directors to do that. I don't think it has to be 50% of your list, though. I just think it would be unfair if I didn't have a Barolo on my list or something like that.
Right,
you know,
right.
You have to have some recognition.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. But personally, on our list, we draw the line with Pinot Grigio. There's no Pinot Grigio on it.
I have one Pinot Grigio, and I would call it, you know, quote, a real Pinot Grigio.
Okay,
that one is Venica, and you know, there's a small bit of skin maceration. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly yellow or white wine. It has that faint blush color. There's really aromatics, you know. Pinot Grigio.
It's not $30, right? It's a little bit more expensive.
I think it's $55.
Right.
Yeah, you know, it's still reasonable, but it's not $30. It's one of our mid priced wines. But the big important thing for Pinot Grigio with me is Pinot Grigio is a Pinot, right? It's aromatic. So if the wine doesn't pop out of the glass with beautiful aromatics, it's not going to ever make the cut on the list.
Look, I mean, do you find that guests are taken aback by a $55 Pinot Grigio that has a little bit of color and is flavorful, as opposed to something that's really bland?
It requires a conversation. Mm-hmm. Like anything else, you know. I think oftentimes that I've had many experiences where people say it's the best Pinot Grigio they've ever had, because people don't think that Pinot Grigio can be something of quality. And Pinot Grigio is one of my favorite grapes. I mean, I've as many hundreds of examples of watery Pinot Grigio that I could show you. I could show you dozens of beautiful examples of rich and interesting and aromatic Pinot Grigio. So as long as you're engaging with that guest, then mm-hmm. I think it's okay. But the $55 price point, yes, they may be more inclined to go for a Sylvaner that's less expensive that they've not heard of and find that they enjoy that just as much.
Well, I mean, I'm with you. I love the Venica Pinot Grigio. But we're gonna off air have to challenge about the dozens of other exciting Pinot Grigios.
Deal.
You know, so we participated in an interesting tasting together with Mr. Alan Richmond from GQ magazine.
That's
and
right.
He had this preposterous idea that sommeliers couldn't tell whether a wine was white or red. Or where it was from, if they were blindfolded.
That he was the only one that wasn't capable that day.
We had you and me and a couple other sommeliers, and we, you know, everyone, it was like double blind. It was like in a black glass, and we were all blindfolded.
Mm-hmm.
And it went.
That was a hilarious day. I mean, I understand, because we gave him totally unfair wines. We gave him a skin fermented white wine that was quite tannic, and we gave him a, you know, very, very pale skinned, I don't know, is it a Beaujolais? I'm not remembering. But something that would have, you know, tricked the mind into being white. And we gave ourselves more classic examples. I think we had a California Chardonnay and a French Pinot Noir. But I know there's something that triggers in my brain when you smell California Chardonnay. It was just not mistakable. I didn't need my eyes to detect that wine. Before I tasted it, I knew what that one was.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that you know, the tasting, I guess we all chose wines for each other. That's
true. Of course,
true.
That's right.
And we all blind tasted. And It was a little, you know, I also got a California Chardonnay that had some oak tannin to it. And mm-hmm. I think that was the trick that was supposed
to happen.
That's
right. That was supposed to be the game there. The Pinot Noir being fruity and fresh and soft. But
it wasn't that hard.
Sorry, Alan.
I think you just deserved a little, you know,
It was a fun game. And we were all nervous because no one wants to be the one quote wine expert that can't detect the French Burgundy.
Well, other than blindfolded tasting, how often do you participate in blind tastings? Are you mm-hmm. you're studying for the WSET diploma right now?
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, as much as I can. I love to do blind tastings with my staff, but I'm guiding them, so that's different. But I have a little group of women in wine that we have our secret society of blind tasting.
Do you think this is? I mean, if you're doing it biweekly, you must think that's pretty useful. I don't know if you've had a chance to read Eric Asimov's book yet. He hates blind tasting.
I know.
He goes completely against it.
I think blind tasting is useful. I have learned things about myself through blind tasting. I don't think blind tasting is the only way to understand wine, but you learn things about yourself that way. I'm trying to think what I even mean by that. But maybe you say your favorite. In my mind, my favorite of all the white wines from Alsace is Riesling, and you start blind tasting, and lo and behold, that's not really your favorite, you know, or. You think that Gewürztraminer always does this, and in fact, the last time you tasted a Gewürztraminer, you thought it was a Riesling, so maybe it doesn't always do this. You figure things out. I think when you know what you're tasting, you presuppose things. You presuppose that certain wines have high acid, but if you're blind tasting them, you might not feel that way. So I don't know.
I think that's a good point when... Yeah, at this point, I'm sure that you can look at a wine on a wine list or look at the bottle and have a good idea of what it might taste like. And so mm-hmm. then when you taste that, you're probably looking for those things
sure.
in the wine.
Exactly.
And then when you blind taste, it's not coming with any of those, any of those prejudgments and just having an open mind to what's in the glass.
That's right. I think blind tasting... older wines is very interesting, you know, how you perceive age and how age is... Anyway, I think there is a usefulness to blind tasting. I don't think that you should blind taste all wine for enjoyment. There's something to be said about just opening the bottle and taking it at face value. But it's an educational tool. Once it stops being that, then it's a parlor trick. So I think if you keep it in the context of trying to understand something about yourself and mm-hmm. how you taste, then it's useful.
I agree with that, and I like it. I find it's also very educational. So you have a big wedding coming up.
I do have a big wedding.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
What are you going to be serving?
Well, Abigail Kirsch is the caterer, and she's wonderful, so the food is covered. I'm not the least bit nervous there. The wines will be Italian. They are near and dear to my heart. And actually, there's a funny story for how the featured wine of the day is getting there. This must have been 2 or maybe 3 years ago. If you remember one of your winemaker dinners with Stefano Anama.
At Lartuzzi.
Yeah. So I went to a winemaker dinner hosted at Lartuzzi and sat next to the winemaker and really enjoyed his company that night and learned a tremendous amount and... it was the first time that I thought that Suave could be serious, so that was very cool to taste really excellent Suave. And since then, the following fall, I went and participated in Harvest with Stefano and spent some time in the Veneto and really just fell in love with that area and the wines that they produce. And he has been quite a mentor to me in the last, 3 years since I've known him. And so he is an honored guest at the wedding. And we will be serving Anama Suave and his Carmignere, the Carmignere Pew with the little Merlot in there. So we'll be drinking his wines.
That's incredible. I absolutely love that story.
Mm-hmm. And that's your connection there. So
wow. Mm-hmm. I just absolutely love that story. And I feel like our paths have crossed so many times over the years that we are meant to be good friends, and I'm looking forward to joining you at the wedding and toasting you with
the last
one.
Absolutely.
I just wanted to thank you, Laura, so much for being on the show. I think that you have such a refreshing approach to wine, and you're just absolutely one of the sweetest, nicest, most down-to-earth people in the wine industry. And I think that you are a great ambassador for kind of our generation.
Thank you.
Of what service and hospitality and what someone what a wine person can be like, and what the best of what we can do. So thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you
for
being on the show. My pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. Just a reminder to check out heritageradionetwork.org and click donate if you want to become a member. And this has been In the Drink on Heritage Radio Network.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.